Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
Good morning. You want to hear a great story? You want to hear a story of men of valor and people afraid, of heroes and villains, and jesters and queens, of crowns and scepters? It is all in this book called Esther. It is one of the most enjoyable, entertaining, and profound books that you will ever read in any kind of literature. The subtlety and the power, those sounds like contradictions, but they're not. They are pervasive in this book. It is a book that's like our lives, not like some of the books in the Bible. When they tell stories in the Bible, I'm a little bit envious to have lived maybe in a time where there's a pillar of fire to follow. Yeah, that's God. Let's go where he goes. 10 plagues and parting Red Seas, that sort of thing. He's showing off. I mean, literally, God is showing off in the book of Exodus. It's purposeful. He makes his point. But the book of Esther, God's name is never used. I don't mean his formal name, Jehovah. There's no word God in the book of Esther. It's a controversial book. Every time they kind of write the canon or whatever, what gets in the Bible and what doesn't, Esther is always has its head on the mat there. Just, well, are you going to make this or not? Never uses God's name. It's a fun book. It's an entertaining book. It's hard to find the hero, though. If you don't know literature like the way Hebrews memorize things, you'll never even know who the hero is. It just slips right by. He's kind of silent in the background, but he's the one that's making all the big plays. Esther's written as a story. It's a story book. It's the most entertaining of the books that have feasts attached to them. There's 7 feasts that Jewish celebrate every year. If you have Jewish friends and you want to understand their faith, please, for your sake, pick Esther. It's called the Feast of Purim, and it's fun. I mean, the kids dress up, and they have a lot of fun. It's a story to be memorized, to be enjoyed. There's shouting and cheering, and there's great food at the end. Don't go to Passover. Go to Purim. This book is a threat to people that hate Jews. Jew haters hate this book, Esther. The Nazis in the death camps in the Second World War banned any reference to this book, Esther, because they knew the power of the book. And even though God's name is never mentioned and there's no big giants being killed, the people of those death camps knew what the story meant. And so they would memorize the book because it's easy to be memorized. It's got a meter to it, and there's a symmetry that we'll find that makes it intriguing. And so they would talk in Esther terms back and forth, and the prison guards wouldn't even know. It's a wonderful story. We think in stories. We remember in stories. Our brain is designed to enjoy a great story. And that's the way this book is written. Let me read a quote for you. We anticipate, this is the power of stories. We anticipate, hope, despair, believe, doubt, plan, revise, criticize, construct, gossip, learn, hate, live in story. This very short, packed little book is simple to read and understand, but profound and deep in its theology and difficult to live out. This is a great story. If you'll turn to Esther, it is in the Old Testament. It is right before the book of Psalms, which is probably right about middle of your Bibles. Go back a couple of books there, and Esther will be there. Now, to understand a great story, you have to understand the major characters. And the first major character we're going to find ourselves learning about is King Xerxes. And let me tell you a little bit about King Xerxes before we even read the first verse, because most of this book is walking around the eggshells that are left, or skulls that are left around King Xerxes. Now, he is unimaginable in his cruelty and in his violence. He literally believes he's a god, maybe even God. And there is nothing that he won't do to express his will of things. There's the father of history, the person all that invented history, is a gentleman named Herodotus, and he is a contemporary with Xerxes. And a third of all of Herodotus' writings are about Xerxes, and particularly about the war between Greece and Persia. Xerxes is the king of Persia. And he loved writing about Xerxes because he was such a colorful individual, and this war was a prolonged war with some of the most famous battles that you and I have ever even heard of. He writes, his description of Xerxes is this: he is bold and ambitious and handsome and stately, and here's the one that matters: he is self-indulgent in every area. Ah, that's the sound of rain. It's pleasant, isn't it? Remember that? Rain? You remember? Yeah. Here's the thing with Xerxes, okay? And know this: you never say no to him. You never, whatever he asks, you do not say no. He thinks he's a god. He gets his will done. And so, for example, he makes a sexual advance on his sister-in-law, his brother's own wife. And she rebuffs him. She says no. And so Xerxes molests their daughter, then kills their family and destroys their entire army. The army and family of his own brother. You know why? Because he can. And nobody tells him no. He has a friend named Pythias. He's an older man, probably knew his dad, Darius, Xerxes' dad. And Xerxes is going out to battle. And so Pythias sends him $11 million in sterling, and just to help him with this battle. And because of his enamored loyalty, Xerxes sends the silver back with a rather handsome gift and says, "Thank you so much for being one of my faithful followers." So Pythias says, "Well, you're welcome. And you know what? I'll send you my army as well. I'll send you my sons." "Well, but I'm growing old and feeble and I need help. And so if it wouldn't be bad, I'd like to withhold my eldest son from you so that I could use him." Now, Xerxes is so infuriated that Pythias is not giving him that oldest son, he brings his army to Pythias' home, cuts the oldest son in half, and has the army of Pythias walk through the two halves. Do you know why? Because he could. And no one tells him no. That's the kind of man he is. When he finishes his father Darius's palace, this extravagant, opulent palace, he carves this into the cornerstone of his dad's castle: "I am Xerxes, the great king, the only king, the king of all countries which speak all kinds of languages, the king of this entire big and far-reaching earth. I am the son of Darius, a Persian, a son of Persian descent." So here, just a couple words. There were a lot of words to describe, but I used volatile sociopath. And probably a third word which would be helpful would be drunk. He's a volatile, unpredictable person without a conscience, and he's perpetually drunk. And you don't tell him no. And you need to understand that the vultures are always fat around him. People are always dying. He has a rage that is without breaks, and there's no one to put a stop to it. It's only one way. And listen, the tension of this book is around this man's volatility and his lack of conscience. No one knows how he's going to respond or what he's going to do next. No one wants him to hear the word no. And so everybody basically lives in fear around him. That's the context. That's the context of the first verse of Esther chapter 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who was ruler over 127 provinces stretching from India to the Nile River.
And at that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. That was the southern palace that he had. And on the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet, okay, to all his nobles and officials and the military leaders of Persia and Media. The princes and the nobles of the provinces were all present there. Verse 4. For a whole 180 days, 6 months, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. Of course he did. And when those days were over, the king had a banquet lasting 7 days. And it was in the enclosed garden of the king's palace, and the people from the least to the greatest who were there in the citadel were to participate. So here's a key word, because this is key to the book. I don't want to slow us down, but the word is banquet. And the reason it's so important is in Esther, the word will be used 20 times. That's almost the same amount as the entire rest of the Old Testament. And banquet is the key to finding the hero of the story and how God works. Banquet's also important because right here, what's happening is Xerxes is getting ready to go out to war with Greece. His father, Darius, lost at the famous Battle of Marathon. And Xerxes is going to act out his revenge upon Greece. And what he's doing, he's amassing all of his armies from all of the 127 provinces. And that's taking about 6 months. So every time a new army would roll in, they'd have a big parade, and they'd get everybody ready to go. And then they would just wait, take 6 months. And after everybody's there, he throws this party for 7 days that is decadent and debaucherous. And they just drink as much as they possibly can. It says after the description of his palace in Susa, okay, it goes on into all the details. We're supposed to be quite impressed with that. It says that Xerxes had to make a law that everyone would drink in excess, but at their own pace. Because whenever the king drinks, everyone drinks. And he realized they couldn't keep up with him. And so he says, okay, 7 days, let's do this and let's do it right. Let's get drunk. But you guys will have to go at your own pace. I'm Xerxes. And after 7 days of this, he's showing off, if you look at it carefully, you can see that he's showing off all that he has. And it kind of comes to a culmination where Xerxes says, okay, you've seen all my stuff, but you haven't seen my greatest possession. My queen Vashti. You should see my queen when she wears her crown. Many believe he meant only her crown. And so he sends his eunuchs to go get the queen, who's entertaining some other guests, to come and show herself to his drunken frat brothers. And then show what she looks like for everyone to see. And then Vashti says this. Queen Vashti says this. Listen carefully, because this is everything. She says, no. She says, no. She says no to King Xerxes. And you know what happens when people say no to King Xerxes? Heads roll. People die. Punishment is distributed. He's not used to that. And so we pick up the story now in verse 15. All the lawyers, his advisors are calibrating at what the expense of this is going to be. Verse 15, according to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti for saying no? She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs has taken to her. And so this individual replied, one of his lawyers there, helps in the presence of the king and his nobles. He says this, Queen Vashti has done wrong, and not only against the king and against all the nobles and all the people in the provinces of the king Xerxes, everyone she has sinned against. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women. And so they will despise their husbands and say, well, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she would not come. This very day, the Persians and the Median women of nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. And there will be no end to the disrespect and discord. You hear what they're saying? Word's getting out already about what Queen Vashti did. This is the ancient Near East. Xerxes, you have lost face in front of all of us to a woman. you'd better lay down a heavy precedent here because it's going to start spreading and everybody's going to quote Queen Vashti. If she can get away with it, anyone can get away with it. So, verse 19 and 20, therefore, here's what we need to do. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to be entered into the presence of King Xerxes. And let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she, someone who doesn't know how to say no. And when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout the vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Very important set of verses here. Did you see the comment in there? It says the law of the Persians and the Medes. That's where we get the figure of speech even today. And the laws of the Medes and Persians. It cannot be nulled or voided. Whatever is written and decreed and sealed with his ring, it is the law of the God. And the God can never be wrong, even if he's drunk and he's getting advice from drunk men. It can never be usurped. The second thing is, you see there, that the consequence for her choice, Vashti will be banished and she'll never come to the palace again and she will never be seen or heard of ever again. Now, that's a Friday night, and then Saturday morning, Xerxes wakes up and he's looking for his queen and she's not there and but he can't do anything about it. Look at verse 1 of the second chapter. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti. Oh, yeah. And what she had done. Oh, yeah. And then what he decreed about her. Oh, right. And he can't do anything about it. Because he'd have to admit he's wrong about the decree, and he can't be wrong. And so he's all lonely and missing a queen. And then his advisors help him again. This is where the plot gets good. Verse 2, and the king's personal attendants propose this. Let a search be made of beautiful young virgins for the king, and let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem of the citadel of Susa, and let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who will be in charge of the women, and let the beauty treatments be given to them. Okay, let me explain what's happening. So he wakes up, he's sad because he did this. Vashti said no, but, you know, kind of she was probably right to say no. But he can't admit any of that. And so his friends say, look, we'll just find you another king or queen. Now think of this as a parent or as a young woman. Girls 14 to 20 that were attractive in appearance from the 127 provinces, men would be in charge of sending troops door to door, and they would grab these girls and pull them out of their houses and put them on carts and send them to the palace in Susa, where they'd be crammed in a giant dormitory where they would be well fed, and then they would go through a year's worth of preparation in beauty supplies and how to dress and how to conduct yourself in front of a crazy king. They would lose their virtue to this madman. They would be sent into this rape room, and if they were not pleasing to this narcissist, they would be sent back to the general harem, and they would never see their family or any other man again. And they would be in a very small, enclosed quarters, and it would be hot. And they would live out the rest of their life barren. That's it. That's if you lose. If you win, if on the night of this despicable act, 14, 16, 20-year-old girl, if she is chosen, then she has to be the king, the queen of this madman for life and never say no. That's the story. It doesn't make a very good veggie tale, does it? You wouldn't want to think of your daughters when you think of this story. This is what it means to lose. This is what it means to win. nobody really wins. And so while everyone's being rounded up in these 127 provinces, at this point, I think that if I understand the chronology right, Xerxes has taken all these men and weapons, 700,000 men, about 1,207 giant battleships. He has 3,000 accompanying cruisers of those ships, and he is going to defeat Greece. Now, listen, technically, he has already defeated Greece. Everyone in history and everyone with any kind of military background knows that Xerxes has already won. Athens is ready to surrender, but here's the thing. Xerxes wants to beat them big. He wants to run up the score. And so Greece figures out the only hope for them left. I mean, they're figuring out how to get out the white flags. Greece figures out, well, let's appeal to his ego. And so they set a trap and they find out who his spies are, and they say, oh gosh, all of our boats are trapped inside this little canal, and woe is us. And so Xerxes sends 3 days of rowing, sends his 1,200 battleships there with the 3,000 accompanying cruisers, and the whole thing is a trap. The Greeks are just waiting for him to come on in there, and he's set up his throne up on this high hill. It's this giant golden throne, and he's looking down at them like Zeus looks down upon his people. And it was a slaughter. They could only come in 20 at a time, and the Greeks waited for the morning wind to hit the boat sideways, and so they couldn't steer fast enough. Here's, let me just describe for you what history says about this battle. It was the greatest loss in Western civilization maritime history that had ever taken place. Xerxes watched his fleet get ruined. One man who was there wrote, it would take 10 days to describe the thousands of men who drowned. When Xerxes was having to run from this famous maritime battle, he had to cross a pontoon bridge that his Corps of Engineers built. But a typhoon hit the pontoon bridge and destroyed it. And so Xerxes, because now he's infuriated by his humiliation by the Greeks, he has the water beaten with rods 500 times. Then he had fires built and had with hot irons, he scalded the ocean. And then beheaded every member of the Corps of Engineers. And he's coming home for a queen. And that queen is you or your daughter. That's the story. That's how it looks. And he's mad. Chapter 2, verse 5. The next major character is Mordecai. And there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin, and his name is Mordecai, the son of Jair. And he had been carried away from Jerusalem during the exile of when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, took them away, and he was one of the captives from Judah. Okay, I'm just going to call him a shrewd Jew. We will know him. He's an older man, and he knows how things work and how even God works in this difficult time. The next person that we're introduced to is Esther. And you're going to see that her primary attribute, you'll see in her introduction, look at verse 7. And Mordecai had a cousin, okay, so this shrewd Jew has a cousin, he's much older than her, named Hadassah, who had was brought up because, here it is, she had neither father nor mother. Oh, she's an orphan. Oh, okay, good. The girl was also known as Esther and was lovely in form and feature, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter because her father and mother had died. Okay, she's an orphan twice in two verses. So the point is our author wants us to know that Esther is an innocent orphan. And she's, in many respects, a victim of a lot of different circumstances that she had nothing to do with. And apparently she's quite pretty. No, I'm sorry. She's not pretty. She's beautiful. Pretty, that's skin deep and doesn't weather well. Beauty is soul, and it blooms as the years go by. That's how Esther is. And you'll see in here that, look at 8 and 9 there, it says that when the king's order, an edict had been proclaimed. Many of the girls were brought. They were actually stolen and taken to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther was also violently taken from the king's to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who was in charge of the harem, the girl, look what it says, the girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately, he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. That saying there that she pleased him and won his favor, it could also be translated, her face shone upon his face. Her face shone upon his face. In other words, her essence, her strength radiated towards him. And one of the ways that we see that she does that is she takes his advice. She shows him great respect, and she takes his advice. And he already has an affection towards her because of that great respect and strength. One of the attributes of great character is what Esther has. It's this proverb. There's a different translation in your bulletin. Wise men and women seek advice, while fools cannot wait to display their stupidity. Esther's going to be taking the advice of her father figure Mordecai. And then when she's cut off from him, she's going to take the advice of this Haggai fellow that runs the entire harem. And he would know how to do things and what the king likes and doesn't like. She's a wise young lady, but she's still in a difficult place. Look at verse 15 of chapter 2, 15 through 18. And when the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, okay, she's an orphan, to go to the king, she asked nothing other than what Haggai recommended, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem. So she's taking advice from him. And Esther won favor in everyone who saw her. She was taking the king Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And this is Esther's fate. As she is walking down, just picture if you could, she's walking down the corridor of the king's bedroom where she will be violated. It'll be a first sexual experience, and it will be with this monster. And I wonder if she's thinking, how did I get here? What did I do to deserve any of this, right? There's a phrase, it goes like this, how much is your sin going to cost me? You think she was thinking that? I mean, what am I even doing in Persia in the first place? My ancestors turned their back on God. They rejected him and they rejected his protection, and that's how the Babylonians captured us. And that's how we got to Babylon, and that's how we got to Persia, because they beat up the Babylonians. And so I'm living with somebody else's consequences. Vashti, if Vashti would have just said yes, I wouldn't be here. Here's the plan. Here is God's will for Esther's life, okay? That Mordecai, her cousin, who is her father figure, would find a God-fearing gentleman and choose him to be the husband of Esther. And they would live a great life together, and they would have children, and they would fear God together, and they would be prosperous in the eyes of God because they fear him. And now, what's other people's sins going to cost her now? She's going to have to find out, isn't she? You don't have to live long. You don't have to be very insightful. You can read the Bible, or you can just live life. You can say these words: How much is your sin going to cost me? You know, if you're growing up somewhere around adolescence, you start looking around, and you realize, you know what? I'm paying the dues for my parents' stuff. Like alcoholism. You know, when you grow up in an alcoholic family, you start realizing that you cannot have conversations that are difficult. You don't know how. You know how, you know, 72 ways to avoid them. You don't know how to trust others, so you don't. And some people, they don't even know how to feel. I find it interesting that sometimes when you're asking the question, how much is your sin going to cost me? Sometimes it's not overt and dramatic like alcoholism. Sometimes it's just inheriting your father's pride or your mother's vanity. And it carries into all your relationships, and especially your relationship with God. How much is your sin going to cost me? I can't see past my addiction to be comfortable. And sometimes, you know, it's just a business partner that's making money while he's leaving you poor. That's how much it's going to cost you. And sometimes it's seriously evil. An evil person doing whatever he or she wants and leaving you broken. How much is your sin going to cost me? That's the story of Esther. That's the story of a lot of us. But listen, the real deeper questions, if you'll entertain them, if you can endure the silence long enough, you'll be asking questions like that matter, that are in this book. Where was God when? Does he not care? Does he not have a plan? Maybe he doesn't have the power to do anything. Will there ever be justice? Will there ever be justice? And I have found in just talking with people that have had to ask this question in a significant way, how much is your sin going to cost me? It's not so much what we experience in life, it is how we respond to what we experience. That's everything. And we need to watch carefully the way the major characters respond to this. It'd be pretty easy for Esther to be walking down that corridor and just weeping just pitiful prayers about woe is me. I mean, that's the contemporary way of doing things now. I mean, that's the very popular way of doing things right now. It's just to be a victim and like label yourself as that type of person. I will be forever known as a person with this story, and that's why I always need help. And you're always asking for help and always being needy and sometimes even breaking into child speak, talking like a little girl or a little boy. Can't wait to tell people the story so that they'll see you as this victim. And that's a pathetic way to live. Kind of the older model, you see older people in the room. The American way was you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You put your head down and you plow. You cowboy up. You get this done. And while that's more productive than being, you know, filled with pity, it hardens your heart. It grows calloused and hard, and it blocks intimacy with your mate, with friends, with God. And, you know, you might even get to the top of a corporate ladder, but you're grinding your teeth all the time. You think that's what God would have us do? I think there's probably another option. And the other option, I'm going to put it simply, but it's not easy, and I don't want you to knee-jerk and be repulsed by it. But the third option is that you trust God in very big ways, not for understanding the events in your life that are evil, but for trying to understand that God is huge and is sovereign. It is kneeling before the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. And that sovereignty, let me explain what sovereignty means. It's trusting this formula that God does have a plan and he does have the power to pull off the plan. And I'm not saying it's easy. And I'm not asking you to do that this week. I'm just asking you to entertain the thought that there might be a lot more going on and you just want to be part of whatever that lot more is. If you can have faith and trust in this providence, a nickname for sovereignty, then what happens, first of all, is that your heart stays tender towards God, and you're able to hear him, and your spirit is able to rest in peace because you know that there will be justice. That every single person will give an account for every single event and careless word that they ever say. And it will not be your job to make sure that happens. And so not only does your heart stay kind of soft and your spirit get peaceful, but then you get enacted in you courage to walk down that dreadful corridor. Because you start seeing yourself as part of something more. Mother Teresa, who knows more about evil in many respects in our lifetime? And she said, look, I just want to be a pencil in the hands of God. I just want to be used by him to draw or to write whatever he wills. That's what the story of Esther is about. I mean, the kind of the big punchline for this is that God providentially, sovereignly, is going to provide protection for his people that love him and are called to his plan. That God in his providence will provide protection to those who love him and love his plan. And he's going to do it in some kind of crazy ways. Here's all I'm asking for this week. I'm asking for you to think about the times in your mind that you have considered that sentence, how much is your sin going to cost me? And instead of getting bitter and resentful and just seething with anger, whether you're smiling or grinding, could you consider for our series together in this book called Esther, would you consider putting trust in the sovereignty of God, that he has a plan and he has the power to make it happen? This book, I have stories, but one is dear to me. A very dear friend of mine's wife, we went through this book together years and years ago. And after sitting through the book itself, she said, I'll let it go. Changed her life, changed her marriage, changed her whole demeanor. Because she saw the story of Esther unfold over a period of time. She saw it in her own life. Would you consider taking that same journey? This is the most fascinating story in the Old Testament. It is the prayer, I'll show you later, it is the prayer I go to when I'm scared and I am trapped. This book is the answer for me when I'm scared and trapped. I love this story because this story is our story. It's a story of crowns and scepters and villains and heroes. It's a story of queens and jesters. And we all play a part. Look, today we're going to have some people up front that would love to pray with you. I'm asking you to consider even that as an application. Would you consider coming down front and having somebody just hold your hand? Tell them briefly what you need to pray for. And they can pray for you. And here's one of the things I'd like you to consider asking prayer in. Would you pray that I will lean into trusting God and his sovereignty in a world of evil? That's what I'm asking. And I'm asking you to come back. Are you kidding? You're not going to come back? She's walking down this hallway. You don't know, you want to know how the story goes? Of course you do. Come on. Dear God, Lord, I'd ask that you would help us. So many of us have been ignoring the sentence. So much of our lives we've been ignoring, and we're living out the consequences of other people's sins, and it has embittered us. And we walk around, we put on a face. And Lord, I'd ask that you give us quiet times, that we might be haunted by the deeper questions that plague us about wondering about where you were when these things happen, and why don't you care, it seems like, and will there be justice? Lord, help us grasp sovereignty in the context of life where there's no burning bushes or giants falling or axe heads floating. Jesus walking around turning water into wine. It just seems like it'd be easier to be faithful back then. Lord, I'd ask that you would help us identify with this woman, Esther, and this man, Mordecai. And we'd try to see how life really works out in faith when the whole world around us is despicable and evil. There is no good to be seen, and you seem to be absent. Help us to identify ourselves with these two major characters. In Jesus' name, amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.